Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Gremling. I am joined by Jenny Vrentis of the Weekside Podcast once again this week. And Jenny, we had a... I'm trying to sort out the playoff picture right now. That's kind of the project for the week, I guess. And it is is complete madness. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen with the 7 seed in the NFC. Because like the Vikings are still in it. The Bears are still in it. This is all... I don't know. It's kind of upsetting to have this little clarity at this point.
Yeah, and the 7th seed this year is really... We're seeing the intrigue that that can create, and that's both good and bad. Yeah. You know, it opens up the field, and there are more teams in the conversation, but then you're also looking at some of the teams that are in the conversation, and you're like, this doesn't look like a playoff team. So we may have to expand our minds a little bit in terms of what a playoff team looks like, because someone's going to be there in the 7th seed.
I've written the Vikings off like 3 times this year. I can't deal with them being back in it. We will get to the Vikings a little bit later. We'll also have an ever so brief segment on the firings of Matt Patricia and Bob Quinn in Detroit and David Caldwell in Jacksonville. But we are starting with what the marquee game of the week was, and that was the Chiefs beating the Bucks down in Tampa. And I don't know, it might still be a Super Bowl preview when it's all said and done. But this was one where, look, when you're playing the Chiefs, there's a very pick your poison type of thing going on when it comes to Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce, and where are we going to devote the majority of our coverage. It was a lot of Tyreek Hill working against man coverage with not a whole lot of safety help, and it was completely out of hand in the first quarter. He took this game over. Him and Mahomes were as good as they've been all season, and that was kind of the story of this one.
Yeah, the pick your poison is really accurate here, because they let Tyreek Hill get open and get those long scores and rack up receiving yards in the first half, and then they obviously changed how they played in the second half, but the Chiefs were still able to win the game and still able to, on third down when they needed a first down, complete a shorter pass to Hill to cinch the victory.
That was very fitting to seal the game that way, going to the guy who ends up with, he was over 200 yards in the first quarter, and he ends up 13 for 269 and the 3 touchdowns, all 20 plus yards. I mean, this is 75 yarder, 44 yarder, 20 yarder. And again, it's, you can't necessarily devote a double team to Tyreek Hill, but it was almost like the safeties were unprepared for the fact that he was going to run past, whether it be Carlton Davis or whoever was trying to cover him in man coverage. And look, like you said, they changed up how they did it after the first quarter, and Travis Kelce gets 8 catches from then on in. And this was just kind of a reminder that if you are not going to be in Patrick Mahomes' face and really bother him with pressure, there's not a whole lot you can do against this Chiefs offense at this point.
Right, that's right. That's your best opportunity to disrupt the play, is pressuring Mahomes and somehow throwing off the throw a little bit, because the combination of the players that they have to make plays and the scheming that they have with Andy Reid and Eric Bieniemy finding different ways to get players open every week, there's just not really any way to stop that if you're not getting pressure and disrupting the play before it really gets off.
And as far as the Bucks go, they fall to 7-5. That is actually, that's still pretty comfortably in the playoff picture here, even if the chances of an NFC South title are sort of slipping away from them at this point. But they have their bye week coming up. They have that weird week 13 bye week. So they have a chance to sort of sort things out a little bit more. But offensively, they were better. I mean, look, Brady, he throws 2 interceptions, which obviously is not ideal, but the story with him has been just the lack of downfield accuracy this year, and he hit a couple of deep passes in this game. He hit Gronkowski up the seam. He hit Godwin on a deep post route. He hit Mike Evans on a 4th-and-3 on like a 9 route up the right sideline. He threw the ball, I thought, as well as he has this season, which, again, you're not counting moral victories if you're the Tampa Bay Bucks and the roster they put together, but I thought it was, when stepping back, an encouraging performance by the Bucks offense in this game.
Yeah, I agree with you on how Brady threw the ball. What I thought was interesting was the efforts this week to point out on from multiple former players, some of whom are former teammates of Brady, to point out that the system isn't doing him any favors. It was like the narrative got out there, right? That Bruce Arians' system is hard. You know, they pointed out during the broadcast that quarterbacks in their first year in Arians' system throw more interceptions. Romo went to lengths to describe how when a deep pass is not completed, it may not be Brady's fault. And certainly we saw some examples of that. I think his timing with Evans hasn't been there. And there's the transition period to a new team was exacerbated by the lack of an offseason this year. But I did think it was interesting that the messaging was getting out there. And that, to me, was more worrisome than what we saw on the field. Because I agree with you, Gary. Like, he threw the ball better, and some of the things that hadn't been working, they found ways to work. They clawed back into the game, which raises some questions on the other side about the Chiefs' defense, but that's another topic. But I was more alarmed by this narrative that got out there this week, that maybe Arians isn't the right coach, and maybe the system isn't doing enough to accentuate Tom Brady.
The talking points are definitely getting around to the people they're supposed to get to. It's interesting. I mean, it's too late now. I mean, you're not gonna bring in a new coach. Brady, realistically, I know we joke that he's gonna play forever, but how much longer can this go on? Probably not a whole lot longer. So you're not gonna reset with a new coach at this point. And we can sort of second guess and say, well, maybe they should have come back to some sort of compromise between, the classic Brady Patriots offense, which is, it's impossible to replicate that. We talk about the short offseason. Even with a full offseason, it's impossible to take what he did in New England and bring it to a new city. It's just years and years of building that thing out in Foxborough. So that wasn't necessarily an option, but was there a compromise there where they could have come a little bit more toward Brady than what they did this past offseason? But again, it's done. This offense is what it is. It's not changing. And you just kind of hope that Brady sort of goes on a hot streak down the stretch here. And if he does, yeah, certainly they can go on a run here. I mean, they were 6-2, and we were all, and that was a couple of weeks ago, and we were all kind of saying they're not quite playing their best yet, but they were 6-2. That's pretty good. Let's go out to Indianapolis, where the Tennessee Titans retake the AFC South lead and do it in. I mean, this was what we saw last year. Second half of the season, Derrick Henry just sort of takes over. I will say the one difference in this game is we're used to seeing him sort of take over in the second half of games. This was, he took over in the first half. I mean, he ran up 140 yards and 3 touchdowns by halftime, put the Titans up 3 touchdowns, and they just sort of cruised to a win against a Colts team that had beaten them pretty good in their building on that Thursday night a couple of weeks ago. So I don't know. It's looking a lot like 2019 right now for the Tennessee Titans.
Yeah, and I think you really saw the impact of the Colts not having DeForest Buckner against Derrick Henry. I mean, that really, when I saw that he was out for the game, Gary, I really wanted to take my pick back and switch it to the Titans, but at that point, it was too late. But it had a huge impact on the game. But regardless, I mean, Derrick Henry has picked up exactly where he left off last year, which, to be fair, I doubted. I didn't think he could continue to sustain this kind of workload and continue to be that productive. And yet he has. And, I think he's a rare player. He's a rare body type for that position. And so it was probably unfair of me to say that he couldn't continue to sustain this workload, given the workload he's had over the course of his career, even dating back to high school when he'd have like 400 some touches in a season. But he's been able to sustain it. And that's what got the Titans back on track in a critical game for their season.
Yeah, this is if you go week 10 and later over the last two seasons, so that's 12 games, including the playoffs, he's averaging 146 rushing yards in those games with 16 touchdowns, which is, we don't see that anymore in the NFL. And I don't know what he does conditioning-wise to sort of be able to sustain this level of play through all this contact he takes. But it's whatever he's doing, it's working at this point. As far as the Colts go, obviously still very much in the playoff picture. And look, they're a game out after splitting with the Titans this season. The one thing, besides the fact that they scored fewer points than the Titans in this game, the one thing that you really worry about is that Anthony Costanzo, the left tackle, goes down with what, as of Monday morning, is being termed as not a major knee injury, but it seems like it is an MCL injury, and we will see how that plays out. Because, I mean, we've seen it. They need to protect Phillip Rivers. They need this offensive line fully intact. Rivers does not have the ability to sort of protect himself at this point in his career. So if Costanzo is going to miss time, the Colts are suddenly looking like a team on the brink.
Yeah, and I would say in combination with the defense not playing as it had the previous few weeks against the Titans, I'm feeling less sure about the Colts. I've kind of been unsure about the Colts all season, but they really convinced me the last few weeks, and I probably swung too far to the other side and said, okay, this division is theirs, but the Titans really came in and reasserted themselves.
That's what we do. We overreact one way and then overreact the other way. I mean, that's the business at this point. Let's go out to Foxborough. This was the game that sort of threw the entire week into chaos here. Look, this Patriots defense has struggled so badly this year. They're obviously shorthanded. All their linebackers are gone from last year, all those important veteran linebackers. Stephon Gilmore has not played up to the level that he did a year ago when he was Defensive Player of the Year. So you just kind of figured, okay, well, Arizona's going to go in there. They have this prolific offense, and they're just going to, whatever, they're going to put up their 35 points and sort of cruise to a win here. They had the answers, and Bill Belichick gave his son Steve a lot of credit for putting together this game plan to sort of limit Kyler Murray as a runner in this one, and you could see they were very conscientious in this pass rush, and I mean, look, they don't have much of a pass rush, but they were not running past Murray. They were staying in front of him. They were getting their hands up in front of him and blocking throwing lanes here and sort of keeping him from doing any of these sort of big play stuff that you've seen from him the first part of this year. But when it's all said and done, Cardinals end up with 298 yards of offense despite possessing the ball for over 34 minutes in this one. And that's how it ends up being kept close. You know, Patriots had a big goal line stand on fourth down on the final play of the first half to get out of there without giving points, and they just sort of hung around, and eventually the Cardinals miss a field goal, and the Patriots make a field goal, and the Patriots win a game in which they had 179 yards of offense and two turnovers in this one. I mean, this is not one that profiles as a game you normally win if you're the Patriots.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Although, Gary, you should give yourself a little credit. You did pick the Patriots to win. You were the only one at the MMQB to do so.
I was not shocked. I just wanted to sort of put on the mindset of the rest of the world as I entered this game.
Yeah. It seems like this is one of those Patriot games. Okay, we're used to them winning more games than they do, obviously, than they have this year. But they come in with a really smart game plan for an up-and-coming quarterback. Like, that seems to be right in the Patriots' wheelhouse, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to devise a better game plan than other people have for Kyler Murray. And to your point about keeping him contained as a runner, that took all levels of the defense to do that. I mean, there was one play where you saw Stephon Gilmore kind of come up and force Murray to go out to the sideline. So there you have a corner participating in corralling Murray and blocking his ability to run. So they really did have a smart game plan, and the defense has been a disappointment this year, but it played at such a high level last season, and their down players, key players, opted out before the year, as you mentioned Gilmore, which the reports that Belichick looked into trading him before the season started should have been a signal, one, that Belichick figured this season wouldn't go the way the past seasons had been, mm-hmm. and also that he was kind of at that tipping point that Belichick seems to be very good at identifying with players, where, you know, maybe last season was the high point and wanted to get ahead of it with a move. So those were all signals that we probably should have read more into at the time. But this was, you know, I always enjoy watching a smart Patriots defensive game plan. So this was a joy to watch in that regard.
This was. And I mean, look, you mentioned Gilmore as far as helping corral Kyler Murray in this one. Gilmore was locked up on DeAndre Hopkins. And again, it's been a disappointing year for Gilmore this one, but he won this battle with Hopkins in this game. And Hopkins ends up 5 for 55. He drew one holding penalty. They had one weird offsetting pass interference penalty. That was really, it was a penalty on Hopkins, but they end up throwing the flag on Gilmore as well. But he won this battle. I mean, this was sort of just vintage Patriots and vintage Stephon Gilmore in this one. And I will say, I mean, look, I can't really picture what it must be like to be a veteran on the Patriots, where you are playing for Super Bowl every year, and then all of a sudden you're just out there and you're an also-ran, and you know, they're on the fringe of the AFC playoff picture, but they're realistically they're probably not going to make it to the postseason. So to go out there and give a performance like this, and again that fourth and goal stop at the end of the first half was just sort of a just sort of a reminder that whether it's symbolic or not, that this team is they're still going to compete, they're still going to go out there, that there's still a certain amount of pride being put into it, when frankly I don't know if anyone would blame them if they just sort of mailed it in for the last month of the season.
You're right. That is a very interesting psychological question when you've been so good for so long and so dominant, and then you have a down year. It would be easy to just chalk it up. Okay, this year's kind of a wash. Let's try again next year. But they haven't done that, and you know, they have young players that are still proving themselves, and here they have one of the top teams in the NFL coming into their home stadium, and they make a stand against them.
All right, we will have a little bit more on the NFC wildcard picture. But hang on one second, Jenny, because right now it is time for the SI Fantasy segment presented by DraftKings. And I am joined, as always, by Michael Fabiano as we trudge into the stretch run here in the fantasy playoffs upcoming in some leagues. I mean, week 13, some people start around then, but this is crunch time here, no matter whether your postseason is starting or not. So, Fabs, we need some early waiver wire help here this week, and there's got to be someone somewhere out there. Start with the running backs.
Yeah, there's plenty, man. There's plenty. I'm not guaranteeing they're going to lead you to a title, but there's plenty of options. So at running back, Cam Akers is a guy that I like. 9 carries, 84 yards, had a 61-yard run against San Francisco. He's the best back the Rams have right now. I don't think Daryl Henderson's healthy. He just hasn't been right since he's had that quad issue. Akers has had a touchdown in 2 straight games. I don't know that he's more than a flex play against the Cardinals coming up, but I feel like he's an add and stash because maybe he ends up taking over the job during the fantasy playoffs. We talked about James White last week. He's still available in about 50% of leagues. He had 6 touches, which is not a lot, but he had 2 touchdowns. And he's now giving you 29 fantasy points in the last 2 weeks with no Rex Burkhead. Chargers coming up next could be a high-scoring game, so White should be added. Atlanta's backfield, I'll tell you right now, I don't know. Brian Hill played more snaps. Ito Smith had more touches and was the better option. Does that mean it's going to happen again next week? I don't know. I really don't know. So both guys are worth a look. I think Brian Hill's probably been added in a lot of leagues because Todd Gurley went down, but it might not even matter. If Gurley doesn't play, then then these guys are probably flex starters at best. If Gurley's back, this is much ado about nothing. And regardless, they got the Saints next week. That defense is nasty good against running backs. So it's desperation. Ito Smith, Brian Hill. Frank Gore, who is going to be here long after the rest of us are dead, he'll probably still be playing football, and Adam Gase will probably still be his head coach. But he had a 53% touch share against the Dolphins, and he's had a 48% touch share the last 2 weeks, and he's got the Raiders coming up. Raiders aren't good against the run.
No.
So, listen, I know he's 400 years old, but he's getting touches, man. A couple of other backs. Devontae Booker. So Josh Jacobs got hurt in the Atlanta game. And I don't know how badly it is, how badly he's hurt, but if he's out, Booker's a really good play next week against the Jets. And then Alexander Mattison, like Dalvin Cook, and I love the guy. He's supremely talented, right? But every time he gets hurt, doesn't it seem like his career is over? Like he can't walk off the field on his own power and he is in excruciating pain. And then he came back into the game. But I don't know how bad his injury is. So as a reminder, folks, you got to handcuff those stud running backs. So Alexander Mattison should be owned just in case.
You get the sense on that Dalvin Cook injury, it was maybe a little bit of wounded pride after the lost fumble, after the
Jeremy
Chin show.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. Yeah, I don't. It's weird, right? Because like we've seen that a couple times. What was it against Chicago? Was it against Chicago also where he got a little bit dinged up? And
Chicago,
then we're like, oh no! And
Seattle,
then he came back
Seattle
in.
Seattle on the Sunday night, where he didn't come back, but he did. I mean, he didn't miss any time after that. So
I don't know, man. All I know is that as someone who has Dalvin Cook all over the place, I was scared, and I thought, God darn it, I'm going to lose him again. And I'm thinking, I'm never drafting him again. He can never stay healthy. And then he came back in the game. But regardless, I mean, if you've got Dalvin Cook, you have to have Alexander Mattison. And if yesterday didn't prove that, then you'll never pick him up. It's just insurance.
For the sake of your blood pressure, go get Alex Mattison.
That's for sure.
Yeah. How about wide receivers?
So you're going to think I'm crazy here. And maybe I am. But we're in week 13, folks. There ain't much out there. T.Y. Hilton got dropped in a lot of leagues. Now, yesterday he played 53 snaps. He had 81 yards and a touchdown against Tennessee. He's seeing five or more targets just about every game this season. He's got the Texans this week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a intelligent NFL fan, T.Y. owns Houston.
Okay? Yeah.
He has scored 15-plus fantasy points against them in three of his last four games. He has scored 26-plus points against them five times in his career. So I'm not saying you go out and pick up T.Y. Hilton and start him. But if you're in a deeper league, maybe you have multiple flexes. Maybe you've got one of the Tampa Bay wide receivers, maybe one of the Panthers wide receivers, and you need somebody for the week. I mean, you could do worse. You could do worse. That's all I'm saying. It's not a glowing, review of T.Y. I'm just telling you that he's had success against Houston and he's coming off a pretty good game. Mm-hmm. Some other wide receivers, Gabriel Davis played 59 snaps and had a touchdown. By the way, Cole Beasley threw that touchdown pass against the Chargers. Mm-hmm. John Brown's on injured reserve. So Davis is going to see more work moving forward. They got the Niners coming up. Not a great matchup, but again, not somebody you necessarily have to start. We're just talking about adding. Colin Johnson was the best Jaguars wide receiver. No one started him. No one picked him up. He played 51 snaps. He had 96 yards and nearly 20 fantasy points. He was Mike Glennon's favorite target. I will say this. If DJ Chark and Chris Conley can't go again next week, and they've got the Vikings, it's a really good matchup. I'd still rather have Keelan Cole and or Laviska Shenault, but Johnson's clearly on the radar.
Yeah.
A couple of other players, Brashad Perriman's had double-digit fantasy points in three straight games. I know it's a Jet, but whatever. And then Alan Lazard had a touchdown against the Bears, and Aaron Rodgers is playing at a bananas level at this point, so it's nice to have shares of some Packers wide receivers. So they've got the Eagles coming up in their next game.
How about the quarterback scene here?
This one's a little thin. It's a little thin. If you can get Ryan Fitzpatrick, go get him. I hated when they replaced him. Hated it because he's so good and he makes everybody around him better. And that's Ryan Fitzpatrick I'm talking about, not Dan Marino. But he had two touchdowns and nearly 20 fantasy points against the Jets. Tua Tagovailoa could be out a few weeks, according to reports. Fitz has given you 19-plus fantasy points in five of seven games. He's been really good. And he's got the Bengals coming up next. Revenge game. I know they're all revenge games for Fitz. Kirk Cousins. And again, not the sexiest dude in the world. I didn't love the matchup against Carolina. I thought they were going to run the ball with a lot of success and he wasn't going to have to throw it. Well, he threw it 45 times. What do I know? Had three touchdowns and over 26 fantasy points. He's now scored 20-plus points in three of his last four games, and he's got Jacksonville next. And they stink. Three other quarterbacks. You're going to yell at me here. Derek Carr. He sucked. He had 0.6 of a point against Atlanta, okay? I understand. The NFL is a week-to-week league. He's got the Jets next. I'm not saying he's a top-10 starter, but he's got the Jets next, okay? Phillip Rivers has got Houston. That's a good matchup. Mm-hmm. And then for those who are desperate, those in two QB or super flex leagues, Mike Glennon didn't look terrible. It wasn't bad, okay? I'm not saying he's a superstar. I'm just saying desperation. And then Colt McCoy could get the start for the Giants. Again, desperation. Okay, and they've got, I believe, Seattle next on the schedule. And I understand that it's Colt McCoy. I get it. I understand. But, this is sort of where we're at right now, folks. this is deeper to QB or Superflex leagues.
There
traditional leagues, neither one of these guys is being touched. But I try to cover all my angles here.
That's why we bring you on, but we're not going to let you go yet because you still got to give us some tight ends here.
Yeah, we can do that. The number one guy is, of course, the player that you should be starting during the holiday season, and that's Rudolph. Mm-hmm. Kyle Rudolph, right? 8 targets, 7 catches, 68 yards, over almost 14 fantasy points against the Panthers. So Adam Thielen is out with COVID-19. I don't know if he's going to come back next week. If he does, then, you know, Kyle loses some of his luster for sure. But Irv Smith Jr. is also dealing with injuries too. So, and it's the Jaguars next week. So it is what it is. Dalton Schultz. I feel like I've been talking about Dalton Schultz for weeks and no one's picking him up. Maybe they just don't want Dalton Schultz. I don't know. 26 targets in his last 4 games.
Yeah.
Like, that's a lot. Andy Dalton, like, really trust this guy. And Andy Dalton, you know, he's a mediocre quarterback at best. Now, here's the thing. I don't know if they're going to play next week because you got the Ravens going up in week 3. I don't know what's going on with that game. So, but Schultz is worth a look. So is Trey Burton, who he had a 14% target share against the Titans, 42 yards and a touchdown. He's given you 10 plus points in 2 straight games in 4 of his last 6. And I mean, if you can get 10 from your tight end, like right now, I mean, you're feeling pretty good about yourself. And, you know, the matchup against the Texans is favorable. And then Logan Thomas, who was one of my favorite DFS plays last week, because I know the Cowboys suck, and he had a very good matchup, 16.7% target share, had a touchdown, 13.4 fantasy points. They actually, remember, he threw a pass, mm-hmm. and then they also used him kind of as a quarterback too. I wonder if ESPN will give him a quarterback eligibility. Probably not. But they have the Steelers coming up, which is not the greatest matchup, but it's week 13, folks, and we're talking about desperation here. And Logan Thomas, he's played, you know, more snaps and run more routes just about than any tight end in the league. So he's always on the field.
There you go. Thin position. I mean, you know, beggars can't be choosers at this point. Logan Thomas, nothing wrong with that.
And by the way, Tyler Bass had another big game.
Mm-hmm.
Damn it. And how mm-hmm. about Younghoe Koo? Younghoe Koo was better than I think, 5 quarterbacks. He's a kicker, folks.
Yeah, and look, he played through injury, too. He got rolled up on an offside attempted block there.
He had 21 points, okay? So he scored more points than Ryan Fitzpatrick, Ryan Tannehill, Baker Mayfield, Phillip Rivers, Taysom Hill, Justin Herbert, Matthew Stafford, Josh Allen, Matt Ryan. You get my point. Kickers matter. That's mm-hmm. that's. I mean, I have a few leagues where I have Younghoe Koo. I'm so like literal with like pronunciation, and Hoe does not spell way to me. So I always have it in the back of my mind. I think it's Younghoe Koo. Dude, he was a league winner, or he was a matchup winner this yeah. week with those
Absolutely.
Points. Yep. So I had to get my kickers in there, man. Tyler Bass was pretty good too.
Always with the kickers. No, Fabs, we appreciate it every week. Look, he's here every Monday. He is on the SI Fantasy Podcast all the time. If you hate podcasts, and I don't know how you got this far into the show if you do, but if you hate podcasts, SI.com/fantasy. Get all his stuff in written form. Fabs, always a pleasure. We will talk to you next Monday.
You got it, my man.
All right, a welcome back to Jenny Vrentis, and we have lots more from Sunday's action to get to, but we are going to start with some of the off-field action before we get to it, and that was a couple of firings. Always a bummer. It's Thanksgiving weekend. No one should be fired Thanksgiving weekend, but here we are. We'll start in Detroit, Jenny. Matt Patricia and Bob Quinn are out, and look, they had what seemed like a playoff mandate this year from ownership. They're not going to get there, and so this was all just kind of, I guess, kind of expected.
Yeah, and the way that the team has been playing the last few weeks especially just look entirely checked out. What we described earlier about the Patriots is what the Lions are not doing. They're not still in games, even if the season might be slipping away. And just think the biggest thing is that Patricia is supposed to be a defensive coach, and his defenses have been horrendous. I mean, obviously the win-loss record is the biggest thing, but mm-hmm. here he has a specialty, and they haven't even been good at his specialty, and they haven't shown any signs of progress or building. So I think when you're evaluating a coach and you just see that this is going nowhere, there hasn't been any advancement forward, there would be nothing to build off of next season. And so you make the move now so you can hire a search firm or whatever direction you decide to go in and begin the search, because there's a lot of other teams now that have a jump on the process.
Connor Orr has the week off, but he has so many thoughts about search firms and how much he does not like search firms. But no, you're absolutely right. And look, Matt Patricia was Bob Quinn's guy. They got rid of a lot of talented players who maybe weren't a fit in Patricia's locker room, and then they brought in their own guys, and it's year three, and it's clearly not working. Like you said, defensive side of the ball, I mean, they're just terrible. You can't live with it that way if Matt Patricia is your coach. And Dave Caldwell out in Jacksonville, the sort of long tenured GM there, who it's just sort of, I don't want to say I forgot about Dave Caldwell, but it's like when they brought in Coughlin, it was kind of like he was, you know, you sort of set aside a little bit, and you sort of maybe forgot he was there, quite frankly. And but now he is no longer going to be there as the Jaguars. You wonder if this is going to be it for Doug Marrone? You know, you wonder if this is sort of going to lead to even more of a regime change in Jacksonville.
Yeah, it was a little surprising they didn't make the move with both the GM and the coach at the same time. But it's possible that they just thought Marrone, let him finish out the season. He would be the best option to finish out the season. It's hard to imagine they don't change both by the time the 2020 season is over, because it's always hard to go in with the GM and a head coach on different timelines, and this doesn't make sense. You won't get your best pick of GMs if you already have a head coach in place, and the results have been disappointing in Jacksonville.
They have. Well, let's go on to the action here. Packers Bears, the Sunday night game, and here's a GM and a coach who are on different timelines in Chicago, and we'll see what happens with them down the stretch here. But we'll start optimistically and talk about the Packers and what they did in this one. This was definitely the best game they played since that Thursday night blowout in San Francisco. They had 41 points in this game, and look, whatever you think about this Packers-Bears matchup and the fact that the Packers obviously have very much gotten the better of the Bears during the Aaron Rodgers years, Packers scored a total of 31 points in the two meetings a year ago, and they had 27 at halftime. They end up hanging 41 on a good Bears defense in this one. It was just, for anyone sort of wringing their hands about the Packers, maybe you're not completely out of the woods, but this certainly makes you feel very good about this team going forward.
Yeah, there just have been some inconsistencies with the Packers. But nights like this remind you that they are really good, and they give you hope that they could have some long postseason run. Because I think we're trying to, as you talked about at the top of the show, sort out the NFC picture and try to determine like who's actually good. It's different from the AFC, I think. The AFC is really crowded. The NFC, we're trying to say like who's actually good in this conference. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to tell. But despite some hiccups, the Packers are very good.
So the Bears end up turning back to Mitchell Trubisky in this one with Nick Foles out. I know everyone sort of queued up their Mitchell Trubisky tweets. Got the drafts ready for when Sunday night rolled around. I'm not going to say he was good in this game, but he was okay. You could live with this performance if the defense was not so non-competitive in this one. If you're the Bears, I thought this was the best their offense has looked in a very long time. And you know, he threw two interceptions. One was forced. One was a really bad read that he'll have to live with that, I guess. And then he of course had, you know, he lost a fumble that was scooped and scored. Quite frankly, if he was Aaron Rodgers, he probably would have gotten a face mask flag on that play, but that's neither here nor there. But I mean, they were aggressive. You have to be aggressive with them. They put him on the move a little bit. They used his legs a little bit. I don't want to overstate it, but this was above the baseline of acceptable quarterback play, which is something the Bears just haven't been at in a long time.
You know, that's a really good way to put it, Gary. And it's a difficult situation in Chicago because they make the playoffs that first season and they make the trade for Khalil Mack. And so everybody thinks they're trying to win now, and it's, you know, this team is primed and it's just the quarterback that's holding them back. And by virtue of being in the draft class with Mahomes and Watson, that comparison is just hanging over Trubisky. And I just wonder if he had been in a different draft class and there wasn't always that ready comparison to be made, if maybe things would be a little bit different.
I think about Ryan Tannehill a lot.
Yes, Gary, I was just going to make that comparison. Go ahead.
No, because Tannehill was a first round pick. He was like 17th overall that year. When Tannehill sort of washed out in Miami and he was out there, when the Titans signed Tannehill, it was not like, oh, here's our guy. Tannehill's our savior. It was kind of like, okay, well, this is a guy who now has no pressure on him. There's something just sort of liberating in that for Ryan Tannehill. And obviously he found the right system. And I'm not necessarily saying Trubisky goes out there and becomes Tannehill, but, you know, Trubisky is more like in the Blake Bortles category, where no matter where he lands, he's just kind of, it's mean to say, but he's just kind of a punchline. And it's because he was the number two pick in front of Watson and Mahomes. And had he gone late first round that year or something like that, it's a different narrative. And there's probably a different kind of pressure being put on him, because I know he always says, like, oh, I don't do social media, I don't look at what they're saying about me in the media. But you can't avoid that.
Yeah, Tannehill was eighth that year, but he was after Luck and RG3. So you didn't really think about it, right? Because Luck was supposed to be this generational prospect, which he was, but obviously injuries and a combination of circumstances made his career go a different direction before he decided to walk away. And then RG3, there was always, you know, so much discussion about RG3. So they dominated the conversation. And then Tannehill's in Miami and, you know, teams are kind of mediocre, and it just wasn't the same level of scrutiny that Trubisky has gotten. He was the third guy who was taken after the other two guys, whereas Trubisky should have been the third guy, but he was taken first. And so the narrative gets flipped.
Yeah. I mean, the alternate universe where, like, I don't know, the Browns take Watson and then the Bears take Mahomes and Trubisky just, I don't know, Texans or whatever, and just sort of hangs out as a Kirk Cousins type dude. And it's a much different life, probably a much happier life for him. He'll get a shot somewhere after the season. Obviously, it won't be as a starter, but we'll see if he can be a successful reclamation project somewhere. But like I said, when the Titans signed Tannehill, no one thought anything of it. He was just going to be a backup there, and then all of a sudden, you know, everything sort of worked out for him. But poor Mitch. Let's go out to 49ers Rams, and look, 49ers have now beaten the Rams in four straight. And both games this year were upset victories for the 49ers. And I mean, look, Sean McVay can coach, Kyle Shanahan can coach, and Shanahan has just gotten the better of him repeatedly, including, I mean, this is we'll get into the playoff picture in a second, but Nick Mullins' game, Debo Samuel's back. Debo Samuel was great in this game for the 49ers, and they have the answers. They just find the answers offensively.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good testimonial to Kyle Shanahan's ability to coach. Their roster has just been ravaged across the board, and they've still come up with creative ways. And Robert Saleh, you know, he's kind of been forgotten a little bit this year because the team's record isn't very good, but he would be a very appealing head coaching candidate. And look at the game plan they put together for the Rams, especially in the first half of that game.
So, I don't know. We all kind of waited for the Rams to get back in this one. And I shouldn't say of all people, but he does play defense, so you wouldn't expect that to necessarily be the case. But Aaron Donald just sort of took this game over in the third quarter and early in the fourth, including a forced fumble of Raheem Mostert that ended up being scoop and score. That sort of got the Rams back into it, and the Rams retook the lead after trailing for most of the second half, and it was just kind of like, okay, this is going to play out as we thought it would play out. And then you just get two, you know, 49ers end up hanging on defensively. They get two late field goals, and that's it. As far as the playoff picture goes, look, if we're talking about alternate universes, and I love to do that, if the Cardinals don't get that Hail Mary to beat the Bills, Right now, it is a 1,000-team tie for the seventh seed in the NFC at 5-6, and the Vikings are in on that. The Bears are in on that. The Cardinals would be 5-6 at that point, and the 49ers are sitting at 5-6 right now. So they're, again, kind of like the Vikings. You know, they've been written off repeatedly this year, and yet they're still just kind of hanging around here.
Yeah, they're hanging around with some of these surprising wins. And it was interesting to hear Sean McVay kind of publicly call out Goff. I thought his comments were pretty strong in terms of, we just have to do a better job of not turning over the ball. It sounded like he was sending a little bit of a message to his quarterback, whose turnover woes have really creeped up the last few weeks and have resulted in some of these bad losses for the Rams, certainly against the 49ers and then the memorable game against the Dolphins.
Yeah, it's kind of,
or not so memorable for Goff, yes. I guess.
Quite memorable for many of us who sat through that first half. Yeah, it's I mean, look, that's the criticism of Goff. When they get off schedule, whether it be getting into a bunch of third and longs, or whether it be a game where they fall behind, he just hasn't been good enough at this point. You kind of we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. Goff has done a very good job in a very good system over the years, but you kind of wonder if at some point they'll just kind of be looking for more, especially considering what you have to pay a top flight quarterback at this point, and you know the kind of contract that Goff ended up getting. But this was. Look, the Rams and Seahawks are obviously sort of battling it out for the NFC West here. This was one that you kind of chalked up as a win here for the Rams, an expected win. They still get Arizona twice. They get the Patriots at home, and they still have to go to Seattle. Seahawks have a much easier schedule down the stretch. Obviously, we don't know what happened in Monday night yet in Philadelphia, but. This was a tough one to get away from the Rams if they are going to end up beating the Seahawks this year in that division race. But we'll see how it plays out. The Vikings, okay. So the Vikings, who again we've all given up on them multiple times this year. We probably gave up on them multiple times during this game against the Panthers on Sunday afternoon. That was just completely it was completely wild. And I guess we'll start with Jeremy Chinn. I don't know what else you say about Jeremy Chinn. He had two fumble return touchdowns. This is the Panthers rookie safety. Two fumble return touchdowns in a 10-second span in the third quarter to give the Panthers an 11-point lead. And it was just, I don't know, it was just kind of that sort of game. Just wild, sloppy, and just a lot of just kind of stupid stuff happening in this game.
Yeah, and I also feel like that sort of is how the Panthers play, that they're just kind of scrappy like that, and they come up with plays when you might not expect them. They weren't supposed to be very good this year, but they've come up with a lot of surprising performances, I guess plucky would be the word. And like, so that's the kind of thing, like they just come up with these plays that just seem totally wild, but they make them happen.
This was I mean, look, the Panthers are 4-8 this year. I think a lot of us didn't think they'd win four games all season. I thought this was like a 2-14 type of roster they put together in what is a full rebuild in Matt Rhule's first year. But they were right there in this one. They end up giving up. I mean, look, credit Kirk Cousins in this one. They are the Vikings are down 6 points. They get the ball back with a minute 51 left, and Cousins brings them 75 yards and 7 plays. Chad Beebe, who had this just crushing muffed punt to allow the Panthers to take a 6-point lead, he ends up catching the game winning touchdown. This is a game where Adam Thielen was out because of COVID protocols. It was a game the Vikings absolutely had to have to stay in the playoff picture, and they got it, and they just got it in such an unlikely series of ways. And then of course the Panthers come right back. They end up with a 54 yard try to potentially win it on the final play, and Joey Sly just missed it. Every Panthers game ends with Joey Sly missing a very, very long field goal. That's a tradition at this point.
Yeah, well, and I would say for the Panthers, because the expectations were low this year, this kind of game is meaningful because it shows that, you know, you can deliver these kinds of performances, even though they ultimately came up short. That was a well-played game, and, you know, they almost came out with a win against an opponent that's been, well, you know, the Vikings have been up and down, as you said, Gary. Don't know exactly what to make of them, but I don't know. I took away a lot of positives for the Panthers from that game.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a really nice season. And again, they're professional football players, so you don't want to emphasize the moral victories too much. But this has been a really nice year for the Panthers to just be competitive week in and week out for the most part. Let's go out to Denver. I don't even know what else to say about the actual game at this point. The Broncos, all three quarterbacks, ineligible to play because of COVID protocol. So they end up starting Kendall Hinton, a practice squad wide receiver who, early in his career at Wake Forest played some quarterback. And, they weren't going to be competitive. And, Connor kind of wrote about this on Sunday. There was something of a fascination of like, oh, what's this going to be? You know, they got this dual threat guy who, you know, they're throwing him in there at the last minute. This might be really interesting. It wasn't very interesting. It was just they didn't have an offense. They completed one pass. They converted one third down. They scored 3 points. That was directly off a turnover. They had 1 yard on that scoring drive. It was just kind of stupid to watch this game be played.
Yeah, and when you are that depleted at the most important position on the field, you do worry about the safety of playing the game. I mean, this comes up in taking conversations all the time. When you deplete your roster, are you putting your players at some risk by putting them out there? And certainly when you have an entirely depleted quarterback depth chart, you worry about that going into the game. Now, I understand why it was played. I mean, the NFL is saying you essentially flouted our protocols, and mm-hmm. so you can't play. And I did think that that was a strong step to take. And they, you know, but I think there's also risks that the players are exposed to as a result of that. So it just wasn't a good situation overall. And I agreed with what Connor wrote. I mean, I thought it was kind of hard to watch. It was super cringy. I didn't really enjoy it at all. I do remember when I was in a beat, Gary, one of the things that you would always do is go around the locker room and ask who the emergency quarterback is. Like, you would try to like ferret out that information. And sometimes teams mm-hmm. kept it very close to the vest. But I remember on the Giants beat at one point in time, it was Jeff Fiegels, the punter. He was the emergency quarterback, which was kind of a funny picture. And then when I covered the Jets, I mean, there was always a former college quarterback type around. I mean, Brad Smith was there for a while, so he could easily step in. I think Jeremy Curley was the emergency quarterback. So you always, you know, a lot of teams kind of have this someone around that takes emergency snaps to be prepared for a situation. But that the idea is sort of like, at the end of the game, if there's a bunch of injuries and you need a couple snaps, it's not to play an entire game.
Yeah, it was. Look, Taysom Hill ends up leading the Saints offense again in this one. They end up running 44 times for 229 yards in a game that, again, was just it wasn't competitive. And you're right, Jenny. Look, the NFL certainly put their foot down on this one with the Broncos sort of asking to have this game postponed or whatever it might be. You just kind of wonder. I mean, I don't know. I realize the sentiment of like, okay, absolutely, it sounds like the quarterback's room did flout the protocols, and you want to sort of have some sort of punitive action against that. But I don't know. Maybe it's fines. Maybe it's draft picks, something like that. Instead of like the actual game, you could have pushed this game back to Monday or Tuesday, and had one of the Broncos quarterbacks participate in it. I don't know. I mean, that's
a good point. Yeah. There are other ways to put your foot down.
Yeah. And I do want to mention this real quick. We'll ever so briefly open up the mailbag because Simon from Australia, who is a friend of the show, and Jenny, I don't know if you know this, but this show is very big in Australia.
Nice.
Simon wanted to ask, so Kendall Hinton had a 0.0 rating. He has a 1 for 9 for 13 yards, 2 interceptions. That is a 0.0 rating. He wanted to know if there have been other 0.0. There have been a lot of 0.0s. Simon, over the years, I have the on one of my thousands of tabs. I have the list up actually. There was last week Ryan Finley in relief of Joe Burrow put up a 0.0. Nathan Peterman in the 2018 opener. But some good all the Mannings, Peyton, Eli, and Archie each had 0.0 games. Terry Bradshaw had 3 of them. Warren Moon had 2 of them. So
wow.
I don't think this is the start of Kendall Hinton's Hall of Fame quarterback career, but we have seen ugly games, whether it be weather or just sort of horrific games by a otherwise good quarterback. That's the way it goes sometimes. So
In good company, evidently, with his 0.0.
Yes, there have been a lot, but maybe none of them quite like this one played out. Let's go to the Giants Bengals, the NFC East as the NFC East turns here. So the Giants end up scraping this win out against a Bengals team that, I mean, look, Joe Judge, special teams coordinator, become head coach. The Bengals special teams kind of kept them in this one. They get the long kickoff return. They get a fake punt conversion. They got a long punt return at the end of this one that almost put them in field goal range for a game winner before it was Jabal Sheard got the strip sack of Brandon Allen to seal this one for the Giants. So the Giants do get the win, but the story in this one, Daniel Jones suffers a hamstring injury. Obviously, we don't know exactly what it's going to be going forward. It seems like it's significant, though. And this, I mean, if Daniel Jones was healthy, I think it's not even a take anymore. I think it's just a factual statement to say the Giants are the favorites in the NFC East. If Daniel Jones is out and Colt McCoy is going to be the quarterback for the next couple of weeks or even just a game or two, this already chaotic division gets thrown into more chaos.
Yeah, and the Giants are just getting some momentum. I mean, again, this game could have gone either way, and that was not a great sign of the overall quality of the team, but the NFC East race is its own thing, and the Giants were gaining some momentum. This was their first win outside of the NFC East. So, and, you know, I would have said that the Giants were looking like a favorite at this point in time to win the division, but now the hamstring injury certainly complicates that.
Oh, man. That division. I mean, you kind of, we'll see with the Eagles to go forward, and if they can right the ship. Certainly, they are a very talented roster. You kind of write off the Cowboys a little bit after that Thursday night game. Although I suppose you shouldn't do that with anyone in this division at this point. But Washington is again. Washington just they have like no interest in scoring points. And it just seems like they were willing to just sort of sit down and be like, all right, we'll take the rest of the season off. And then all of a sudden, it's like just doing nothing is going to move them into the lead in this division somehow. Like by not running the race, they're somehow going to win the race potentially is how this is going to play out, which I guess is it's the way it should end in the NFC East in 2020.
Well, you mentioned some reader or listener mail earlier, and I got a DM from one of the Weak Side loyal listeners, Anthony Brown, and he points out anyone who wins the NFC East is just going to be doing more harm than good because the season is a wash anyway, and you're losing draft position. So if you get to the playoffs, you're automatically picking in the late teens, and wouldn't you be better off just, you know, giving up on the year, which is true. I mean, ultimately a playoff appearance isn't going to mean a lot for these NFC East teams. But if you're a head coach, if you're a GM, you're measured on how many times you made it to the playoffs. And if you go to the playoffs, it's something to build off of. So of course that is going to be the goal and somebody is going to win this division. But yes, ultimately in the long run, what comes of it? Probably not very much.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I will say this. You're going to get to host a playoff game. If you hosted like Tom Brady and the Bucks, if you're the Giants and you get to host Tom Brady and the Bucks in a playoff game, that game feels like a Super Bowl. That I mean, that's a big deal. If I were a Giants fan, I would be up for that game. Yeah. I'd be bummed if they lost, but that would be something to look forward to for a week. But you're right. You're going to jump down a bunch of spots in the draft order if that's the way it plays out. And I don't know. We'll see. They're going to make someone win this division and play a playoff game. We'll see who it ends up being. Let's go up to Orchard Park where look, this Josh Allen Justin Herbert matchup that was you thought you were going to see all these big plays and all these fireworks here. It just didn't happen. Both defenses did a nice job. The Bills defense, which has been rocky this year, you know, a year ago everyone would have said, well, Bills defense is their strength, the quarterback is the problem. It's been the reverse this year, but it was kind of a throwback to that in this game where Josh Allen was a little bit shaky, put a couple of passes in danger, ends up only throwing one interception, but there were no big plays for him in this one. But on the other side, look, Justin Herbert's been the most prolific big play passer in the league since he gained the starting job here, and they did not get any big. I think 18 was their longest pass of the day until a Hail Mary, another Bills opponent Hail Mary here, got them down near the goal line in sort of a meaningless final drive there. So nice job by the Bills defense.
Yeah, it was definitely one of those mixed bag performances for the Bills, because while Allen has taken several steps forward this year, the defense had taken a step back. And so this was a nice performance to sort of maybe get the defense trending back towards where it was last season, or at least to say, hey, we shut down a really good, promising young quarterback that a lot of other teams have had trouble with. But on the flip side, it wasn't a great day for Josh Allen.
Yeah. Josh Allen is streaky. That's what we're going to see down the stretch here. Cole Beasley ended up throwing a touchdown and a trick play, and that's the way this one went. I mean, Bills led for most of it, but it just was kind of more interesting than they probably would have hoped at this point. But let's stay in the AFC East. Dolphins do keep pace, still a game back of the Bills in the division. Ryan Fitzpatrick back in the starting lineup for the injured Tua, and he was fine. I mean, look, running backs lost two fumbles in this one. It was sort of just a sloppy game for Miami, but obviously you have a certain margin for error when you're going up against the Jets.
Yeah, now I guess the question is, when will Tua be able to return? And the Dolphins needed a win like this to stay on track, to potentially be in play for, they're still in play for the AFC East, but perhaps more likely a wild card. But yeah, I'm just curious to see what happens with Tua the rest of the season. That still is the big question. You know, when will he be able to return from the thumb injury, and how will he play when he does?
I like Brian Flores playing the word game a little bit. The when he's healthy, he'll be back in the lineup, and we'll see. I mean, if Ryan Fitzpatrick strings together a bunch of wins here, I mean, does that thumb linger a little bit longer than maybe people expected for Tua? But I don't know. I mean, look, Dolphins are collecting wins here, and that's a good thing. And I think there's no doubt that going forward, if you're looking at 2021 and beyond, it's Tua's team, and they'll get there eventually. We'll just see how urgently they switch back to it. As far as the Jets go, I mean, look, still leading the Trevor Lawrence Derby. Sam Darnold return to the lineup was just, again, not good. Dolphins defense is a tough matchup for a young quarterback, but Darnold just, I mean, he's not doing anything to prevent the Jets from taking a quarterback at the top of the draft, and that's the way it's going to be there.
I mean, it's so strange, Gary. I was reflecting a little bit on that draft, and Darnold was supposed to be the safest selection. And it's not all his fault. I mean, he's been in a tough situation in New York, and he hasn't had a lot of support around him. If you look at the players that he's been throwing to, it's not an imposing cast of characters. They let Robbie Anderson go to Carolina, and the Gase pairing hasn't been what they had hoped. But you know, he was supposed to be the safest one with the highest floor, and the Jets felt really good about being able to get him where they did.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, he'll probably have to sit for a year or two wherever he goes next. But I've been saying Pittsburgh, go to Pittsburgh. The weird thing about Sam Darnold, and so many quarterbacks are succeeding in these highly schemed offense that involve a lot of play action. Darnold's never been a very good play action quarterback, which is unusual, but not to Ben Roethlisberger is not a play action quarterback. Aaron Rodgers for the longest time was not a play action quarterback. I think there's room in the league for those guys, even if it's not sort of the trendy thing to be. So I've been saying send Darnold to Pittsburgh and let him learn behind Ben for a year or two, and then see if he can sort of recapture this thing. But it's not working in East Rutherford. And I did want to mention before we move on, Jason Sanders, 2 for 2 from beyond 50 yards. Again, the Dolphins kicker has made 10 straight from beyond 50. That's that's very good. That's a very good story.
Wow, yeah.
Let's go to Browns. Browns finally don't have to play in a monsoon. They go down to Jacksonville and just play a normal game against the Jaguars, even if it was a little bit dicey. And overall, I mean, look, the game was too close for comfort, and I don't think any Browns fans are going to be upset about hearing that assessment. Mike Glennon is under, you know, under center for the Jaguars here in this one, and if the Jaguars got a stop, the Browns ended up converting a screen pass on 3rd and 12 to seal the game. But if the Jaguars could have gotten off the field there, they would have gotten the ball back with a chance to come back, come down and kick a field goal to win it. But the Browns do hang on. Nick Chubb, another big day. Baker Mayfield was, everyone will point to the really bad, and he had a couple of really bad misses in the end zone. Just gimme throws that he just missed on. But other than that, he was good. He was accurate for the most part. He was efficient. I thought it was an encouraging step forward for sort of a young quarterback having, again, kind of a rocky season this year.
Yeah. I mean, this game was definitely a little bit more dramatic than maybe the Browns had hoped for going into it, but they end up coming out with a win while the Raiders, which I know we're getting to next, lose, and all of this is important as it comes to the AFC playoff picture.
Yeah, and the Raiders go down to Atlanta. I have so many nice things to say about the 2020 Las Vegas Raiders and how they've sort of, I mean, look, they're not terribly talented, and they've won games, and they haven't won games through like fluky means. They've just sort of won games. They played better than than the sum of their parts. And I mean, this was a complete meltdown in Atlanta, a game that you thought they'd get. And I don't know. I don't know if it's just a letdown after you almost upset the Chiefs and all that stuff. But I mean, this fell apart. They end up with 5 turnovers, 4 of them lost fumbles. Josh Jacobs left with an injury, although that might have been sort of the result of just the game not being competitive and not putting a slightly banged up player back in. But this felt like kind of a death knell here for the Raiders.
Yeah, it did have the feeling of a letdown game, but it is a little reminiscent of last year where they really sputtered toward the finish, and they've been in good position to make the playoffs here, and you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming weeks if they sputter again. But I think they have the Jets next, so hopefully that is a hopefully for the Raiders that will, you know, be an easy way to get back on track.
A nice way to get right there. All right, Jenny, you will be on the Weak Side podcast coming out Tuesday. If y'all out there don't already subscribe to it, you should. Connor's out this week, but man, I am. Can you say the special guest?
Yes, of course.
I love Rohan, NBA writer at the SI.com and huge Dolphins fan, and I used to sit right behind him, and we talked Dolphins all the time, and I would try to convince him that Adam Gase was overachieving with his terrible roster, and he wasn't really hearing it, and he wanted Tua so bad, and now he's gotten Tua, but he lives in LA now, so we never talk about it anymore.
Yeah, and the office is closed, but regardless, yes, very excited. We will have a lot of Dolphins talk on this show. We've been preparing for this for a while. Connor Orr is out on paternity leave, so we've been having Rohan lined up for a few weeks as a special guest whenever the baby came. Now, we didn't think it would be after a week where Ryan Fitzpatrick was starting again, but this is the chaotic Dolphin season, so there's just lots to unpack.
It's fitting. It's very fitting. I'm very much looking forward to that show. And Jenny, thanks again for joining us. We will see you next week.
Yes, always fun.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is Jenny Parentis and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. And Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed as well as all the feeds for the MMQB shows, the Weak Side Podcast featuring Jenny and Connor, the Albert Breer Show featuring Albert Breer. They're all for free on Apple Podcasts. And once you do subscribe, please leave a rating and review for all of them. It really does help other people find the shows, which are also available on Spotify, radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.